Hi there. You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse, and I'm your hostess, Heather Wayman. Hi, everybody. It's Heather Wayman, and welcome to episode 67 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. Do you have a product or a service or an event that you want to promote? Consider sponsoring the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse to reach over 1,500 enthusiastic and engaged belly dance geeks. You can find information about sponsoring the clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com/sponsor. The Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, the things like moves, combos, and choreographies, there are lots of resources out there for you. But if you need help with the why and the how, things like musicality, culture, business, ethics, and composition, that can be a lot harder to find. So every month we interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for questions and answers so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, or maybe red wine and chocolate, you are in the right spot. So today, my guest is Aisha Azar, and she has been active in the Middle Eastern North African dance since 1974. She retired from performance after a 40-year career, but still teaches all over the United States and into Canada. She's considered to have good expertise in Egyptian, Saudi Arabian, and Gulf dances, and also teaches other various dances from the regions where Arab dance is found. Aisha is going to talk with us today about student-oriented learning and techniques that we can use as teachers to best reach our students with our class material. As teachers, it's vital that we're able to tap into the ways that each of our students learn. And as students, it's important to identify what kind of learning styles we connect with. So welcome, Aisha.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here again.
Can you just, can we start off by having you tell us a little bit about your story so that we can get to know you?
I would love to do that. I started dancing in 1974, and my first teacher was Jodet Silhi, who hails from Jordan. And I had seen belly dance. I lived in California in both San Francisco area and in Southern California. And I'd seen belly dance at Renaissance fairs. And for some reason, when I saw Diane Weber, I went, oh my God, I need to know how to do that. I just fell madly in love with the dance. And I'd seen dance before and thought it was lovely, but there was something about her. I never did get to study with her. But to this day, she is my first inspiration. So I did get to study with Jodet Silhi when she was, I now live in Spokane, Washington. I'm originally from Kittery, Maine, so I'm a long way from my real home, but I've lived here a long time now. And Jodet was here to perform at the World's Fair, and she also gave classes while she was here. And then I went on to study with Badawiya, who lives in Portland. And I eventually belonged to three different dance companies, the last of which I founded. I've studied with many, many different dancers over the years, and I highly recommend doing that after you get a good foundation. The main thing is be sure you get a good foundation before you start trying to study with a lot of different people. And so here I am. I've been busy now for, I'm 66 years old. I've danced since I was 21. And I have had a truly miraculous life, I think, as a dancer. And I do continue to teach all over the United States and in Canada. And I love teaching. It's where my heart and soul really has always been. I miss performing. And every now and then I narrate now for my dance company, Baharat Dance Company. They were my dance company that I founded. And I narrate for them every now and again. And sometimes they'll convince me to do like a 4-minute thing of some sort. But that's about all the performing I'm doing these days. I love being in the classroom, and I hope to stay in there as long as I can continue to be a good teacher.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, so we are going to talk about student-oriented learning, and I would like for you to tell us What is Aisha Azar's philosophy on teaching?
My philosophy on teaching is pretty simple, really. It is first, know the material that you're teaching. Know it well. You can't teach what you don't know. So that means you can't go take two workshops and come back and try to teach it to your student. You have to have some actual knowledge behind it. It's, oh dear, what happened?
I know. No, we're getting LA's, we're getting some new folks
people
coming in here. Yeah,
okay.
I hate to interrupt you. Can we just say hello, though?
Yes, absolutely. Why not? Hello.
So we've got someone from the 562 area code. Who's that?
That's me, Sophie.
Sophie, welcome.
Sophie, hi, sweetie.
Hello.
I'm trying to figure out how to get pictures here. Let's go gallery view.
Well, I think Sophie's in on a phone, I believe. So
that's all right.
I'm in a car.
Perfect. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to put you on mute for a few minutes while we get on with the interview here, but we're going to have time for questions and answers at the end. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Sophie.
Sophie and I are very old friends. I won't say how old she is.
Okay. And then we also have someone from 510 area code. Who's that?
My name is Hava.
Hava, thanks for joining us. Where are you calling
Thank
from?
You. Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, perfect. I didn't ask Sophie where she was calling from. Do you know, Aisha?
Around Lancaster.
Okay,
California, somewhere around there. I'm not exactly sure where she is right this minute.
Perfect. Gosh, we got people from both ends of the country here. This is great.
We have. I love that. A few years ago, I taught in New York City. Mark Bellahadia sponsored me there, and I just had the most wonderful time. I just had a blast.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay, Hava, I'm going to mute you now so we can move on with the interview. Is that okay?
Great.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm sorry, Aisha. Please continue.
Okay, where was I? Oh, yeah, I was explaining my teaching philosophy. Know your
material.
Yeah. That's extremely important, not only for you, but especially for your students. If you don't know what you're doing, you can't teach it. And it goes way beyond do this step or that movement. You know, every dance has a heart and soul. And in order to teach the dance, you have to understand its heart and soul. And the second thing is, look at students as individual people. One of the things that used to just drive me crazy after I had been dancing for a while was that you would be packed into these rooms with 60 or 70 people, no mirrors. One person way over there that was teaching, and they never seem to see you. They never seem to look at you and say, I think that you're doing that perfectly, or let's tweak that a little bit. It was just kind of like you were a herd animal. And after a while, I got to where I just wouldn't go to huge events like that because I wasn't getting what I needed as a student. And what that taught me was that if I need to be seen as an individual, probably so does everybody else in this room want that same thing. So my philosophy is really see your students and really understand what you're doing. So that's my philosophy in a nutshell. And I've learned of ways to do that. I have a whole bunch of notes here that I will be looking at every now and then so that I can remember what I think I'm supposed to say. I do believe that there are many good ways to, I'm 66, remember? I think that there are a lot of good ways to teach. And I've been really fortunate in my life to have a couple of instructors that really impacted me as far as how to be a good teacher. Because student-oriented teaching is all about understanding how students learn and doing your best to accommodate their needs rather than just saying, do this movement or do that. I mean, how many of us have been to those workshops where the teacher sees themselves in the mirror and that's all they see? And they say, do this. They don't tell you how to do it, nothing. They don't turn around and see if you're doing it. It's just kind of this blanket, do this thing. I don't think that's a very effective way to learn anything, never mind a dance. I'd been dancing and teaching about 6 years when I became really aware of how little contact a lot of teachers had with actual students. And so I got tired of being treated like a herd animal, and I went, I'm going to design my classes differently. So the first thing I had to do was educate myself to a good degree about the dances that I was teaching. So I may not teach as many dances as a lot of people, but I teach them very thoroughly. My students get a handout that talks about history, about costuming, cultural affiliation, music, etc., etc. And we go over all of those things in class every time. They're really important things. Every single time you walk into a classroom, you have a chance to talk about culture, which is the basis of all dance. There's not a dance in the world that's not affiliated somewhere with a culture. It just doesn't happen, no matter what the dance is. Okay, let me see here. Gotta look at my notes. Some of the things that I talked about, if any of you heard the Amira Jamal interview, she talked about some of these same things. Now, where I got my basic ideas about how students learn was from a man named Howard Gardner. I was taking a class on how to teach English as a second language, and I started studying the work of a man named Howard Gardner. And he's the guy who came up with the multiple intelligences thing. So in trying to teach through this kind of philosophy where people learn in different ways, you have to first of all know how they learn, don't you? You can't just go, well, they learn in different ways. And a lot of us, I think, inherently sort of understand that on a visceral level, but we don't really understand it intellectually. And what Howard Gardner's work did for me is it helped me to understand things more succinctly, what I was trying to do and be as a teacher.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that, because when I'm teaching in a class, and it's probably like this for every teacher, you've got a group of students and you might be trying to teach a thing, whatever it is, and they're just not quite getting it. So if you say it in a different way, or you show them in a different way, or you with permission, of course, use a hands-on approach, suddenly, very often, the light will just go on and they'll get it. It's wonderful. And it's just because they have a different learning style. So you mentioned the multiple intelligences. Could you go into some of the details about the different kinds of learning styles that people have?
Yes, and almost everyone has a group, they use more than one learning style, but they might have one that stands out. Anyway, in Howard Gardner's work, and he now recognizes 9 different intelligences, I have concentrated on these 7, and what I noticed when I was reading about them was that he uses them in classroom situations like going to school, and I noticed that they applied really well to dance classes too. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those. I have to look at my notes, so if you'll forgive me for that.
Of course.
The first learning intelligence that he talked about was linguistic, and this is the ability to understand spoken and written language. And it's one of the reasons why I use anecdotes when I'm teaching, so that people who learn linguistically have something that they can hear and understand through speech. And also that's why I give out handouts. I think handouts are really important for everybody, but they're especially important for people who learn linguistically. They help them to understand better what I'm trying to put across. And there's that thing about having something concrete in your hands once you go home too. You know, the teacher's long gone, but you have this thing that you can touch that's going to prompt memory, I think, in a lot of ways, even before they necessarily read the words on the paper. And so the second one is logical mathematical, which is deductive thinking and reasoning. And these people use numbers well, and they recognize abstract patterns. And usually they're very, very good at learning choreographies. They're very good at figuring things out spatially. How is this going to fit within this perimeter and this boundary? They're very good at things like that. And also, if you're good at logical mathematical things, a lot of times it helps you to understand how music works too, because music is very mathematical. It follows structures just as our dance does. Our dance should be following musical structures. You don't just get out there and go, oh, let's do this movement. If you understand, even on a visceral level, how a cultural bit of music is put together, it helps you to be a better dancer. All righty then. Spatial intelligence is another one that Mr. Gardner mentioned. And this allows dancers to clearly see what movement's doing and also gives them the ability to see how to use space or lack of it effectively. They tend to be dancers that learn by watching. If I'm doing this with my hand, I might not have to explain to them, lift the first knuckle, lift the second knuckle, lift the third knuckle, and straighten your hand. You know, they'll be able to see that in ways that a different kind of learner might not be able to see. Body kinesthetic is another learning intelligence. And these students tend to have a lot of body awareness, and they can learn to control their movements more easily because of it. We all know that dance isn't just about movement, but if you have the ability to not have to concentrate so heavily every time you're trying to learn a movement, that's a plus. And that's something that usually takes us a lot of years, right? I mean, 10 years later, you're still going, I got to intellectualize that before I can make it part of me. So I always, I have anxiety disorder. And one of the things that is really good about having the anxiety disorder is that you are very much body aware all the time. And there are a lot of times when that's a really bad thing. But for dance, I've found that it's a really good thing. So one up for those of us who have that problem. Another form of intelligence is musical or rhythmic intelligence. And dancers with that skill have an easier time finding things in the music. They hear tones and melodies far back in the music that a lot of people miss. And I teach predominantly Egyptian dance, and so that's a really important skill for that particular style, is hearing something way back in there that you can bring forward through movement and through feeling. So that's a really good skill. Also, people with music intelligence don't have any problem at all keeping with the rhythm, and they can easily work in between rhythm too, which in belly dance is a pretty important skill. Interpersonal intelligence, and that helps dancers to build effective communication with their audiences, with other dancers. There are a lot of times the glue that holds a good choreography together because they work well with other people. It's a very important non-movement skill in belly dance, being able to work with others. Intrapersonal. And that's a dancer's ability to reflect on how they feel about what's happening as they dance. They tend to learn well outside of choreography because they're busy connecting emotionally to the experience of the dance. So nearly everyone has more than one of these intelligences, and some, of course, are stronger than others. As teachers, our job is to strive to figure out how our individual students learn. And when we have an intellectual base like the multiple intelligences, I think it gives us something to focus on and say, ah, I can see that, you know, she needs to touch my body in order to understand how I'm making this particular move happen. Or that person there seems to be able to just automatically pick up the rhythm with no problem, even though it's quite complex. So all of these different intelligences help teachers to see how their students learn. And that's one thing that I strived to do in my teaching methodology, was to apply these ideas and manifest them as I was teaching. Let's see here. we need to really see our students. And I use that word a lot. And some people are just like, well, of course we see our students. But I'm talking about seeing clear down to the core, you know, not only the physical things that happen, but the emotional things that happen as well. And so that's what these intelligences are all about. They're about seeing the holistic student, not student, but student. Every single person in that room is a student. Okay.
Yeah. And it's all about, I think it's really important to make connections because, well, it's all about developing relationships too. You know, this isn't just, belly dance isn't just a thing where our body's moving through space. We develop relationships with this too. And if you can, if you're teaching and you have a student that's not quite getting it, and it's because you aren't recognizing what their learning style is, you're going to lose them. And that's really sad, you know? So it's important, I think, for us to be able to recognize these ways that people learn so that we can connect with them. And that they can partake in what this joy that we have in this dance. Yeah.
I agree. And I also feel one of the ways in which I differ from a lot of belly dance teachers is that I feel that it's like ballet or any other dance. Not everybody's going to be a professional belly dancer. Everybody can take classes. Everybody can do the best they can. But I'm also very much in favor of saying, okay, so you're not a great belly dancer. Maybe you're a good drummer. Maybe you're an incredible Debka dancer. I had one student who, she has bipolar disorder. And when she was manic, she couldn't dance her way out of a paper bag physically. But in her head, when she was manic, she could create the most beautiful choreographies you've ever seen in your entire life. I mean, it was just... it almost tears me up because she might not have been able to physically dance, but in her head, oh my God, you couldn't ask for anything more inspiring and wonderful. So I would ask her to choreograph for my other students. And she never, ever got on stage professionally with us, but she was on stage as far as what she had created. And that was enough for her, you know? So even though you may not be the world's greatest belly dancer, maybe there's something else that you can do just as well and get just as much joy out of it. And that's an important thing for teachers to recognize too. Help to students find out what they can do if they're not such great dancers. I have another woman who is the best stage manager you ever met in your life. You know, so always there's room for everybody somewhere in the world of belly dance.
Yes, you mentioned stage manager. I had a student in a showcase. Well, she was in a class several years ago, and she went through all the classes. She was there every single time, and she learned the choreographies. And she was actually quite good as a beginner student. But when it came time to do the showcase, she was like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. I'll be the stage manager. And just like you said, she was the best stage manager ever. She had us all, she knew what we needed before we even knew we needed it.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. All right, so we've talked a little bit about the different styles of learning. And this may seem a little bit basic, but I think it's important. What are some of the main tenets of dance that you feel like are important in teaching?
I think the very first thing that we have to do is... really impress upon our students that there is a musical connection with this dance. You can't get out there and belly dance to Buffalo Gals once you come out tonight. Okay? Or any of those crazy songs, you know?
Don will.
Don, don't you dare. Okay, now she's done it. Okay. I found it very helpful with students to explain what their job as a belly dancer actually is. How many people here know what their job is as a belly dancer? Okay, what is it? What's your job, Don?
To be entertaining, number one.
To be entertaining And what else? Because Jerry Lewis is entertaining, but he's not a belly dancer.
That is correct. But I have seen him dance. And I have seen him mock belly dance, and I still enjoyed it.
Yeah, so but was he belly dancing? That's the thing.
But so, you know, we can get into semantics here. But I think that...
You have to, because the dance is what it is, and it's not anything else.
But I don't think that belly dance is I don't think belly dance is one big cohesive unit. I think that it's a melting pot of different styles. And so being entertaining first is the most important thing for any entertainer. And when somebody takes the stage, whether they're a dancer, a singer, a comedian, their number one job is to present a good entertainment for the audience. You can be a bad belly dancer and a good entertainer and still get paid.
Might still get paid, but that doesn't mean you're doing your job. If you're a bad belly dancer and a good entertainer, you're still not doing your job.
Anyway.
What do you mean? Wait. What do you mean you're not doing your job?
I mean that if you can't belly dance, you're not doing your job as a belly dancer.
I didn't say can't belly dance. I said bad belly
dancer. Bad belly dancer. There's no such thing as a bad belly dancer. You're either a good belly dancer.
Well.
Okay. I think we probably
It's like,
have
you
to.
Know, would you want to have a bad doctor operate on you? You know, it's
like. Well, thankfully, in belly dance, no one's life is at stake.
That's
a good
what
thing.
You think.
Well, as far
anyway,
as the entertainment
should
goes,
I go on say, here?
Yes, please tell us what you feel is the job of the dancer. Yeah.
It is indeed, aside from it obviously being an entertainment, it is entertainment in a very specific way. I use this sentence to tell my beginners what their job is. Belly dance is a physical manifestation of and visual and emotional complement to the music. You can't be a belly dancer without the music because the dance is more than steps. So, in other words, belly dancers do what the music tells them to do on several levels. I often demonstrate by showing them that we might, for example, use movements from the shimmy family during an oud solo, or you might cover horizontal space during a fully orchestrated piece. And within all of this music, there are also folkloric inspirations where you're going to address the fact that, oh, this is from this folk dance, or that doesn't mean you're going to break down and do the whole dance. It means you're going to tip your hat to that little bit of Saidi segment in the music or whatever. So when we make that statement, when we make it clear that they are manifesting the music, we give our student a tool for relating to what they're doing for the entire learning experience. If they don't have that, then they're standing around going, okay, well, I'm not quite clear what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. And so I think that's a really important thing. And this kind of thing is really helpful for those who have musical and interpersonal learning intelligences. Let's see if there's anything else I'm supposed to stay there. I want my students to understand that they're doing something other than arbitrarily moving around inside their skin. They have a job, and their job is to entertain in a very specific way. So let me see. Another thing that I think is really important is teaching posture. I notice a lot of times now people don't seem to have, a lot of the newer dancers don't have an attachment to core in the same way that we used to teach core when I was first coming up. I teach Egyptian belly dance most often, and when I do, posture is one of the most difficult concepts to get across, and it completely affects every other aspect of the physical dance. It's even more difficult when you're looking at all these different dancers, because if you look at Lucy, you see a dancer who kind of leans forward as she's dancing. And if you look at Soher, you see a dancer who stands very straight up. And if you see Fifi, you see a dancer who leans back a bit from the rib cage and also to the side. So people are going, well, they seem to be all very different. But if you look at the center of what they're doing, if you look at the core of what they're doing, they're all doing pretty much basically the same thing. It's their default stance. Posture is always dynamic, no matter if you're learning American cabaret or if you're learning Egyptian. No matter what style you're learning, posture is dynamic. But there are also these sort of default places where you go. And now I have to look at my notes a minute and see what else I'm supposed to say here.
Gordo, I saw your name isn't Gordo, is it?
Yeah.
It is Marsha.
Marsha, okay.
My name is Shia.
Okay, all right.
Was my stage name.
That's funny.
When I was on stage.
Your comment about everybody sitting straighter whenever we start talking about posture, everybody said.
We're all like everybody standing up straighter, making their neck longer.
Exactly. All right.
Okay, so body posture is dynamic. There's also tension held through the core of the body if you're, say, an Egyptian belly dancer. And it comes from the sternum to the pubic bone and into actually the vagina as far as muscularly as well. So there's this core that you sort of dance around. I don't know how to explain it. I heard Raqia Hassan say something about that once. She told somebody, now, okay, dance around yourself. And I understood exactly what she's talking about, but a lot of people in the class are like, what? You know, so that it's because there's this quietness in the middle of Egyptian belly dance. And depending on the individual student, that has to be explained in many ways, and it's something that can take years to understand. I have a dancer who's been with me probably about 12 years now, and she says that after about 10 years, she began to really understand what I was talking about. And she could feel the difference in her body when she finally got that place. So it's not something that's necessarily easy to learn, but it's a really important thing for that particular style. Now, if you're dancing a different style, if you're a Tunisian dancer, you don't need that. If you're dancing dubstep, you don't need that particular stance. If you're an American cabaret dancer or a tribal fusion dancer, you don't need that particular stance. But you do need the stance that is right for the dancer. And so it's not always the same sort of posture that you're going to learn. Again, multiple intelligences really helps as far as this goes. When I was trying to explain, there's a heaviness in Egyptian belly dance posture that you don't see so much in other styles. And I was trying to explain it various ways, you know, showing, holding, teaching, blah, blah, blah. And one of my students said, earth butt. It's like having an earth butt. And so I went, perfect, that's perfect. So now I actually have stolen that term from her when I had to explain it. And she did eventually get it through her own specific way of intellectualizing it.
That's all that matters.
Exactly. Okay, let me see here. What else do I need to say? I believe that culture is something cultural as well as physical. So when you're learning a cultural dance, it's one of the things you need to try to understand is how do these people move around? How do they stand? How do they walk from femur to trochanter? How do they, you know, how does the upper body move, you know? So, and that's, it takes a long time. It really does. It's like, I am the worst Greek folk dancer in the world. I love Greek folk dance. I studied it for 2 years and I finally went, I'm never going to be able to do this. I don't know how to be like these people. I love what they're doing. I'll get up at the party and dance along, but I don't have the thing. So we all have things we can do and can't do. And you can feel sorry for me because I'm not a very good Greek folk dancer.
Okay.
Let's see here. So that takes interpersonal intelligence to understand who you are as a dancer. And like we talked about before, you could be the world's worst Egyptian belly dancer and be the world's best Turkish belly dancer. You know, it's very specific. Recognizing movement families or groups is another thing that's really important for a teacher to do in order to teach students. you have to know what you're doing again before you can teach it. I was really lucky. My second teacher did a really mean thing to me. She was Arab also, and we were talking about the dance one day, sitting watching videos, and she said, you know, we're only doing 10 things. And I went, that's just wrong. No way are you doing just 10 things. And she said, yeah, we are. And I said, okay, what are they? She said, you go out and you watch Egyptian belly dancers and Turkish belly dancers and Lebanese belly dancers, and you come back to me in a few years and you tell me what they are. So I did. And because I really had to watch these women to figure out what they were doing, I did see what those 10 things are. And there are a bajillion variations, there are many layers, but in the end, my 6-month students can say, when Fifi Abdo is doing what he calls Jewel of the Nile, she's doing a half circle that is shaped like a crescent. She is leaning back. She is pulsing her stomach, and she is making circles with her legs over a shimmy. So she's got circle, slide, and shimmy. And, you know, it's really, yeah. And it's really, once you know how to look at it, you see what it is. And it becomes exponentially easier to teach and learn once we are able to say something like that. Because we're not from the culture, we have to do a more intellectual process a lot of times. And eventually that becomes a visceral process. But anyway, can I tell you what my 10 fundamental
Absolutely.
Movements
yeah,
are?
That's what we're here for. We're geeking out. We're doing the intellectual thing.
I left my pocket protector in my other shirt, but I can still geek out. Okay, the first is walk. Okay. On top of posture, everything, posture is the very first thing my students learn. And then after that, we begin to learn movement in correlation with music. What kind of music do you do this movement to? So walk is the first thing. And there are, of course, a million variations on walk. But there's also that fundamental, very basic thing. Every movement has a place where it starts. Every movement has a very, very fundamental, basic thing that has to happen. Walk is one. What I call a basic Egyptian is a trochanter-based movement. That means that it happens. Most people call them hip lifts, things like that. Oop. Happening.
You broke up there just for a second.
I did what?
You broke up there.
Okay. Maybe I'm not sitting still enough or something. So anyway, basic Egyptian, for me, I refer to it as trochanter-based movement, which means that the place where your pelvis and leg connect, the place where your femur is in your pelvis, is where a lot of movement comes from that we refer to as basic Egyptian. Hip lifts, things like that, those aren't coming from your hip. They're coming from that place where your leg and your body connect. And that makes all the difference in the world in how it looks. Shimmy. So again, there's a fundamental thing that happens for shimmy. Depending on what kind of shimmy you're doing, you know, you're going to get different effects. But for me, I always teach as the fundamental, that big blurbly shimmy that Soherzaki used to do. And the reason I teach that is because it's really pretty much the hardest one you're ever going to learn, you know, as far as how you're going to layer it, et cetera, et cetera. People who come to my class from other classes a lot of times can do one shimmy, and that's a freeze. Ugh. And they can't really do anything on top of it or around it or anything. All they can do is a freeze shimmy. So we start with that very fundamental thing of moving again from the trochanters to get that big blurbly Soher thing going on. It's so hot. I love that movement. Okay. Slide. Because I teach Egyptian belly dance, a slide is an extremely important movement because it's a movement that happens way beneath a lot of the other things. You've all seen Soherzaki do this, right? Where she's this hip, this hip, this hip, this hip. She slides over in order to drop. She slides over in order to drop. She doesn't just go bump, 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 bump. She goes, I know that's really hard with my fingers, right? But you understood it. I have to stop for 1 second because my cat, Charles.
Charlie's in charge.
Charlie!
Elizabeth has a kitty too.
Everybody should have. I know. I saw your kitty coming in and out, Elizabeth. I loved that. Oh. Hi. Hi. Oh, he's a tuxedo cat. How nice.
Oh, yeah.
You're beautiful. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Back to being a person. Well, everybody needs to take a little, feline break every now and then, right? Okay. So movement number 5 is turns and spins. Belly dancers do a lot of those, and there are some very specific ones, like we got a band in town who was trying to work with dancers. You came to one of those classes, didn't you, Heather, with Safar?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And one of the things that I had to teach both the band and dancers here in town was that when you want the band to stop a segment of music, what do? You spin. And you learn, I taught the band to go, okay, you're going to do 5 counts, and the dancer will get ready to stop for 4 counts and stop on the last. And I saw the most wonderful thing when I was taking some classes with Fifi Abdo in Texas somewhere. I can't remember where right now, but she was working with the
Dallas with Dee Dee.
It was one of Dee Dee's. Yeah, it was. So anyway, there was this wonderful band that she was working to, and they were very big into Lebanese music, Lebanese Debka, and they were wonderful. The Debka dancers were fabulous. So, but they were not used to dancing, playing for belly dancers. So Fifi's on stage, doing her Fifi thing, and she's like, spin, 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 and up with the arm. So bands usually understand that when you see the dancer spinning like that toward the end of a segment, to stop the music on count 5 when she goes like this. And they didn't know. And so Phoebe's like standing there and she's looking at him. And pretty soon she was just doubling over laughing. It was so funny. So anyway, that's just one reason why you want to teach your students spin, so that they'll know how to make things stop.
Yeah.
Okay, tilt. Tilt is also a really important movement. And it's different than a lot of movements in that, your body tilts everywhere. If I do this on stage, what am I doing? I'm doing a tilt. If I do this on stage, what am I doing? I'm doing a tilt. I can do it with my rib cage. I can do it with my hips. I can do it forward. I can do it backwards. I can do it in a hat. I can do it with a, no, okay. Got confused there for a minute. Thought I was Dr. Seuss. So tilts are very important. And tilts can help you do other movements as well. So that's another one. That's number 6. Number 7 is lock. If I do this, I've done a lock. If I do any kind of movement that ends sharp and under the body, I've done a lock. Any kind of sharp ending to a movement, any kind of thing that you bring to fruition with a sharp movement is a lock. And it doesn't matter. They happen all over the body too. If I do that, I've done a lock. Undulation is number 8. And those happen all over the body. If I do this, I'm doing an undulation. I can't do any other undulations because I'm sitting down and you can't see them. So you'll have to trust me. I know how to do others. Circle, like you just did with your head, happens all over the body. Doesn't matter where you do it, it's still a circle. So you see how these movements are really very fundamental versions of these movements is where you start everything if you're teaching this dance. You make it as easy for your students as you possibly can. So sometimes I've seen teachers break these movements down and they don't get to that fundamental thing that happens. They're adding things or whatever, but you could teach simply a circle. That's all there is to it. It's just a circle. I teach most of these pelvically first before I go anyplace else with them because Egyptian belly dance is so centered in the pelvis. And the last movement is sway. That's figure 8, Mayas, and, sways through the rib cage, all of the sway family. Are there any questions about 10 fundamentals. I know some people are like, no, there's more than that. And for their teaching method, there might be, and I don't have a problem with that. Do I have any questions about that?
Yeah, actually, Dawn asks if you teach these movements or these families in any specific order.
Depending on what the music is doing. When I'm teaching my beginners, I teach them just like this. You know, just what I said to you, I teach them in that order. And then I teach a few variations on those movements that we start using with the proper music so that they get the feel of how these movements work with music. That's really important. No matter how complicated layering or variations in movement become, you see all native dancers using these 10 movements. We already talked about Jewel of the Nile, and it's a movement you can literally see Fifi using those movements. She also pulses her stomach a lot when she dances, and that is a slide. She's not doing an undulation, anything else. She's doing simply, I'll stand up and show you if I can. I have jeans on today, so all she's doing, can you see me?
You'll have to back up just a little bit.
So all she's doing a lot of times is pulse, pulse.
But I saw you pulse that out, and it seemed like an abdominal push rather than a slide.
Yes.
So you're saying sliding
out. Abdominal push? What is an abdominal push?
It's a slide, yeah.
It's a slide.
Okay, yep. I see. Yeah, okay.
So once you begin to simplify all that for your students by saying, this is what we're doing, and this is the family it comes from, this is a slide movement, it makes it a lot clearer, I think, for them. And because we're not from the culture, things that should be clear to us are often not. So we have to find other ways to present. Okay, let me see if there's anything else I want to say here.
Marcia mentioned something that I found interesting too. She said that the pelvis lock to stop the shimmy was always difficult for her. Would you care to demonstrate? I added that.
I can try. I have to move back a little bit. So you've got a shimmy going on. Let me see. Can I get back on up here? I'm in my little crowded room here.
There you go.
And I didn't know I was going to be actually doing any of this. So you've got your shimmy going on, okay? You got your shimmy going on. I don't know if you can see it with these dark colors or not.
We got it.
So one of the things that happens is, as you're doing this, if you're doing it the way Sohair does, you're deep in your pelvis. You push deep into your pelvis. Your rib cages come down. You're not pulling away from the movement. And what happens is, in order to get that pelvic lock, you have to pull back and give yourself some place to lock into. Because if you're already here, there's no place to lock into. So you pull back a little bit. And when you pull back, you pull your stomach muscle in so that the shimmy will continue. If you don't have any core here, your shimmy's not going to continue. So, and then all you're doing once you've pulled back is you have a place to lock into. So it's like, but you have to pull back a little bit in order to have some place to move into. Did that help?
That was fantastic.
Okay.
There you go, Marcia.
I have to get my chair back from Charles. Charles loves to be in here with me, and he got half of this conversation because it's so much about the cats. Okay. Our job as teachers are to really see what our students are doing and help them by using all of our tools. A lot of our tools are multiple intelligence. Some of it is intuitive. Some of it is just that whole thing where I'm constantly saying, really want to be your student. In these 10 movements, we have Gardner's logical, visual, and body awareness intelligences that are all in play when we're discussing movement families. Okay, are we ready to move on?
I think
am I taking
are.
Too long?
No,
should I shut
no,
off?
No, we have plenty of time. You're
okay.
Perfect.
So the next thing is grounding. Grounding in the individual student. Hi, Kitty Face. Students tend to be very individual in the way they connect with the earth as well. And that's earth meaning anything from the actual ground to the theater stage. I'm not a very esoteric teacher. So I don't have people or, you know, any of that. They can if they want to, but I don't teach it as part of my classes because I don't think that's what belly dance is about. I think it's
an... Can I get you to repeat that, what you don't teach in your classes? You cut out that one time too, and I think that was something important.
Okay, I don't teach esoterically because I don't think belly dance is about what we would really call esoteric stuff. It's not about being a goddess. It's about being a human being.
Yeah,
and so I teach it from this very human point of view, I guess you could say. But grounding is not only about posture, but it's the way movement's going to be executed. There are students who are very light on their feet, very airy. How many of you guys know Rafa, who's Aziza's partner for a long time? So Rafa danced with, I don't know if he danced flamenco or if he just danced with a Latin dance group in South America for a long time. And so all of his energy was very much up here, and he was a fabulous dancer. But he understood that he needed to pull down into his pelvis. So he had to learn a new way of grounding in order to do that. So one of the things that we as teachers have to do is we have to look and see how our individual students ground themselves. And there are students who are very light on their feet and they don't seem to hardly touch the earth at all. Some students might have a high center of gravity or a low one. And sometimes it can be manipulated and sometimes it can't. And then that again comes down to, are you going to be a really good tribal fusion dancer or are you going to Tunisian dancer? Two different kinds of grounding have to take place for those two dancers. There are some who naturally understand the pelvis as the default center of their grounded universe, and those students have an easier time learning some styles of belly dance because they already get that deepness through the pelvis, you know, where you want to feel that earth butt heaviness that we talked about earlier. Those kinds of students have an easier time learning some styles of belly dance because that's where the grounding is. All of the native belly dancers, if you study Turkish, if you study Lebanese, if you study Egyptians, they all have that pelvic grounding. Very different from what you see in ballet and a lot of Western dances. Gardner talks about body and kinesthetic intelligence. And a lot of times people that ground that way seem to have a lot of that for some reason. I don't know why that is exactly. Teachers need to be able to see how their students connect to the earth in order to help them find the right place for their weight to settle for any given dance, because it's not all in the same place for every dance you do. Dances have different centers of gravity, and each individual student will have to learn how to hone their ability to establish the right center of gravity for any given dance. Building body awareness is something that most students will do, but they may do it at different times, and they might need an instructor's attention in different ways. I have one student who has to run everything through her logical intelligence before she can do the body awareness thing. So she oftentimes stands there when everybody else is really already there, and yet somehow once she has processed this in her brain, it travels down the body and she gets it right like 99% of the time without, you know, even having physically started the process, I think. I'm always very intrigued by the way individuals learn because I always learn something new too. You know, you learn to really look at your students and see what they're offering you back. As a teacher, I need to learn to respect every individual dance process. And sometimes they're very different from my own, and I really have to pay attention before I can get it. And a good teacher, our whole job is to enhance students' way of learning. We can only do so much. I would say that a teacher is like 20% of your dance process, and you're the rest. Oh, the importance of, pardon me?
Yeah, you have to do the work.
Yes, exactly. Are there any questions about that? Every now and then I remember, oh yeah, this is like my first time doing any sort of thing like this on the computer. I'm really technologically challenged.
You're doing
so. You're all
kind
of fascinating to me. The Duffy with her little horse over there. Okay. So again, we're talking about what the students need as opposed to what's convenient for us as teachers, etc. The hard copy handout. Very important, because if you need a hat, no. It's very old-fashioned, right? But a hard copy handout gives a student a way of remembering what happened in class, first of all. It also gives them a physical object with which to connect after the class is over. When they touch this, it's not only what's written here that happens. All kinds of memory floods in. And it's really important to some kind of learners. And some of them are like, yeah, that's nice. But almost everybody gets something out of it. Anybody who has a strong logical or visual intelligence will find that handouts are really helpful. I hardly ever do a class without handouts. Once in a very, very long time. And then I ask people to take notes so that they have their own handout that they've created. It appeals to people with strong interpersonal intelligence, because a handout is there after I've gone. They still have that connection to me, don't they, if they have this piece of paper. This is their physical connection to me after I've left. Okay.
And if I could just add something to that, you do the handouts, and a lot of times in a class, if I'm teaching a choreography or there's a Zill pattern or something, I'll put it up on a Word document and upload it to my website as a downloadable file or a scribe file. I use Weebly, and they've got this thing that you can put in there, and it puts the file in there. And so they can print it out. And that way it's, we've got the different learning styles. So some people won't give two whits about the handout, and you've printed it off and it'll end up in the trash can or in the back seat of their car on the floorboard or something. But if they want to print it out, it's there for them, and they can. And I always have students print those out. Not everybody, but so that's another way to do it. It is electronic, though.
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's electronic or not, I don't think, as long as those who really can benefit from that get it.
Right.
I just always do handouts, and sometimes it is a big pain. Like, I went to teach some classes. I think it was in either Tennessee or Kentucky, and there were, like, I was teaching like five different classes, and I had this, like, there was no room in my dance suitcase for actual dance stuff, only paper, you know. So, and it's always like, what, these people don't have a printer? Why don't I just relax about that? But no, I'm not going to.
It's your thing.
Yeah.
So, you keep doing you.
That's all I can do, unfortunately. Sometimes I wish I could do like Aziza of Cairo instead, but I just don't think I can. I'm too old.
Yeah, you're Aisha.
I'm Aisha, not of Cairo. I've been there, but I don't live there. Okay. Do you have any other subjects that you want to go into, or do you want me to just continue blabbering along?
I'm really wanting to get into this individual attention and class numbers thing.
Okay.
I think that's really important too. It's all important. There's a lot of important stuff.
I agree. Teaching it really is important to know how to do it if you're going to do it. I think that there are not a lot of really excellent teachers out there. I think that there are some really horrendous teachers out there, and I think that there are a few especially good ones, and I think there are a lot of teachers who are really trying and really learning, and there are a lot of good methods. This just happens to be the way I do it, but I'm not the only person who knows how to teach either. So aside from Gardner, one of the most important things that I talked about earlier is we need to take classes, we need to do the research, we need to see dance as something not separate from a culture, but but part of a culture's way of expressing who the people are. And if you're doing ATS, you are still expressing who the people are in the San Francisco area, in California. It's a uniquely American dance, but it too is a subcultural thing. It doesn't matter what kind of dance you're doing, it's cultural. When a student has questions, once in a while we should be able to say, I don't know the answer. If you don't know, don't pretend you know. Just say, I don't know. Maybe so-and-so has more information on that. A lot of times if I don't know, you know, there are a lot of dances, you ask me a question about them. You ask me a question about Paulia. I can say some superficial things. I can dance it superficially, but I'm no expert, you know. And so I send you to someone who is an expert is the right way to do that. One of the things that seems to be really hard for belly dance teachers is saying, I don't know. And I'm not quite clear why that is, because none of us knows everything by any means. Anyway, me either. It's like, no, I don't know anything about that. I wish I did, but I didn't have time. Okay.
You know, what's really great, though, is when someone does ask you a question, asks me a question that I don't know, it encourages me to go and find out.
Yes.
So I learn more as a result.
Yes.
Also.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And if you can't do anything else, try to send them to the right place. You know, that's really important. So anyway, in the subjects that we teach, that shouldn't happen very often. We should be able to give students some kind of valid information. We can't teach it if we don't know more than just movement, because movement is one part of the dance. It is not the dance. And that's something that I'm seeing a lot of superficial stuff today where people, I mean, I went recently to a show where the girl said she was doing Turkish belly. So I'm like, I don't think she is doing that. Not only because that would be two different cultural affiliations, but also because she was dressed in a belly dance costume and was doing that very Eastern European looking stuff, you know, with the hard movements and et cetera. It was like, I don't think that's what she's doing, you know? So know what you're talking about, because it's confusing enough, as we all know, to be taking classes without a lot of misinformation. The importance of individual attention. It's those individual moments when a teacher is fully focused for a bit on one student that can make a huge difference in whether or not a dancer grasps the concept. It's not only the teaching of the movement, but the fact that the student feels that she's worth it or he's worth it in the eyes of the instructor to spend that moment with you. That's really important. I remember having a couple of teachers do that very, very early in my dance life, and it made all the difference in how I felt that I learned. It's really important. There's not a student who honors us by being in our classes that doesn't deserve that. I mean, they're there, and it helps us to learn on a deeper level, and it helps them to learn on a deeper level. It can be anything. It can be a correction of a movement. It can be a little bit of cultural information that you give specifically to that student. It can be any number of interactions. It can be stopping by and going, so if we tweak this a quarter of an inch, you know, there's a million ways to connect individually with a student. I get really excited when somebody grasps a concept that's been really hard for them. I think I get excited as they do. And the fact that I recognize their hard work, even just that kind of a small thing, gives them something special. They know. Another plus with personal attention is that other students who are paying close attention too, when we interact with an individual, they also learn things. So that's the plus on that. So I do something that a lot of teachers don't do, I limit my class numbers. Anymore, it's not such a problem. It used to be, you know, you'd get 50 or 60 people in a workshop, and how are you going to learn anything? You just, you know, pick up so little, and there's no time for you to go talk to people or any. I've seen exactly one teacher who can walk into a room of 60 people and make everybody in there feel special. One. And I've been taking classes for what? I took classes for 40 years regularly, classes and workshops, et cetera. So
do you want to say who it is or no?
Shireen El-Safi.
Oh, I figured. Yeah. I was in a workshop with her before.
Did you see that same thing?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I also want to say that I learned more in one class from her than I had learned in like 5 years. Before. I don't know if that's just me, if there was something about the way she taught that resonated with me 100% or what, but she's pretty phenomenal. She's amazing. And now I've had some other really good teachers too, but I would say that she's the one that, for whatever reason, she was just the perfect teacher for me. Anyway, where was I before I so rudely interrupted myself here? Oh, okay. It's something that doesn't set well with teachers or sponsors a lot of times. Anymore, it's not as big of a problem because even really famous, incredible teachers and dancers are getting like 15 people at a workshop, it seems like. And I think that's a shame because you need to be there in person. You know, you need to see them in person. You need their 360-degree selves in front of you. I do understand the need to make money and pay bills because I need to make money and pay bills too. You know, making a living teaching is really hard. I performed and taught regularly for 40 years, and 20 of that maybe I was able to make a fairly meager living as a dancer. Not a great living. Anyway, I think there needs to be a measure of respect for those attending our classes. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous to go into a class of 60 people. The teacher never looks at you. If she does, it's just kind of, you know, maybe she'll answer questions. Maybe she won't. Maybe there will be mirrors. Most likely there won't be. So you are clueless unless you have incredible body awareness as to whether you're doing something right or wrong because nobody tells you. You can't see yourself. You know, there's all kinds of problems with these huge things. I can go into a class of 30 and see everybody, but there's no way I can do it in a class of 60. I wish I could, but I can't. And it's really important to me to give something to everybody in that room. I want them to walk away feeling like they got something, especially for themselves. I was a founder of Bharat Dance Company, and we sponsored some pretty wonderful dancers over the years. I ran the dance company for 10 years, and now a lady named Namba Chan runs it, and she's really doing a good job. But we never went into debt to pay our bills. Our members attended all workshops that we sponsored free of charge, and we did this by doing everything very bare bones. We didn't rent the fancy hotel room. We instead rented a restaurant and paid the people a nominal fee, and they got to keep all the food and drink money. And that worked out really well for us for 10 years. We did not rent, again, a fancy hotel room to have workshops. We rented a large dance studio so that there were mirrors, et cetera, et cetera. We collected reasonable dues from our company members, $10 a month. And that way we didn't have to scrounge for plane fare for the people that we hosted. And it wasn't a burden when we brought someone. We didn't, like I said, we didn't rent fancy places. Lastly, we brought up and coming wonderful people that didn't yet have a big name, but were willing to work at a price per student so that we knew we could afford to bring them. And they were wonderful people. They usually were great teachers. They were people that we'd seen perform on stage or seen in classrooms. And we had some great people. Some of them are quite famous now. And we're proud to say that we brought them first, Neener. So anyway, and the thing that was also great about that is when they became famous, they were still willing to come and work for us at a price we could afford. So that's good. I mean, we found that limiting class numbers also gave each student a chance to connect with our guests. And when I go out of town to teach, I ask that sponsors please limit the class size to 30, because that's how many I feel I can teach. But, you know, today it really isn't the problem it used to be, unless you're bringing somebody from maybe out of the country. And I do understand that there are times when exceptions to that, what I've just discussed, need to be made. People in the States who are sponsoring Fifi Abdo and other famous dancers from countries of origin, they need to try to assure that they can meet expenses, and they're going to have expenses based on even culture alone that I might not have if I'm sponsoring somebody from in town. They need to try to assume that they can meet all travel expenses. And there are also things like you need to be able to provide the accommodations that these people are used to having. You know, you can't invite them to stay at your house. You have to put them in a nice hotel. On the other hand, when I go and teach a workshop, as long as there's no vermin in your house, I can usually stay there. And I actually have it in my contract that there can't be vermin, because one time I was teaching workshops and doing a performance down in a place where I won't mention. And the room that they were having me stay in, I walked in and I could see like 9 really big spiders. thinking to myself, you know, if I stay in this room tonight, I'll probably die.
Those are your dance partners, don't you know?
I'm certainly not going to get any sleep with these creatures hanging around. So I just said, you know, I think I'm going to go and stay in a hotel, and I paid for it myself. It was like, you know, I'm sorry. I can't sleep in a room full of predators like this. So it's now in my contract, you know, that I'll stay any place reasonably clean and no vermin. And I bring my own coffee, so that's never a problem. Let me see, what else should I say here? How long should classes last for optimum student benefit? How many of you remember those 5 and 6 hour workshops where you could hardly remember anything, you know, get home and go, I just spent like $70 and I don't remember anything I spent it on. Help. So when I was a younger dancer, workshops did traditionally last all day. And by the end of the day, we were all exhausted and we didn't retain anything. It was just like a waste of our time and money. And when I'd been teaching for a while, I did some research on what is considered the optimum length of time for learning. And most studies showed that 3 hours seemed to be the maximum time in which people effectively learn. So after that, there's this decline in the ability to absorb information. And I teach classes that are 2 hours or under and workshops that are 3 hours long. I find that when I'm teaching, I could go for 6 hours easy. There's something about teaching that is just different. You know, when you're up there teaching, you just have a different kind of energy. But is that what the students need? Do they need me to stand up there for 6 hours? No. They need to stop at about 3 hours. And so that's what I do. And no, I don't make as much money, but I walk away feeling like the dancers got what they needed. And that's what's the most important to me as a teacher. And I'm just out of information on my little notes here.
That was a lot of good stuff.
Well, thank you. I do want to say that this is how I teach. And again, the most two important things are knowing your material and understanding the student as an individual. And basically, after all that, that's what it boils down to.
That was going to be my question. If people take one thing away from this call, what would that be?
Know your material and look at your students, see them, really see them as individual people out there. And that's if you're teaching a workshop or a class or a private class, or if you're lecturing. Because a lot of times when you're talking even, you can look out there and you can see by the expressions on people's face, you know, what they're thinking about or whatever, or you can ask them, you know, is there a question? Did that make sense, or do I need to put it in? that kind of thing. So I think I'm done. And if there are questions, I would love to answer them.
That is exactly what I'd like to do now. Oh, let's see. We got stuff in the chat box. Let's see. Ooh, lots of good stuff here. Okay. We're all sitting straighter. That was when we were talking about posture, right? Okay, the 10 items in the order we teach. Dawn says that's a really solid list, and I think so too.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I love your Facebook page, by the way. You have got the most amazing things going on there. I can't hear you, but it looked like you said thank you, and you're very, very welcome, and thank you.
So I can, I tell you what, I can unmute everybody. That's probably not a good thing to do. I'm going to unmute Marsha because she wants to know if you touch on the 10 fundamental movements or families every class, or do you just concentrate on 3 to 5? And Marsha, you're unmuted, so you can speak with her too.
It depends on what we're learning. I have a series of classes called Exploring, in which we explore each of these 10 fundamental movements sort of by themselves. But when I'm teaching like a more holistic actual dance situation, then we might touch on all 10 or we might touch on 3. It depends on what the music tells us to do.
I see. So your classes, are they 1 hour or 2 hours?
Right now, I'm just doing once a month classes, and they're 2 hours long. In the fall, people have been asking. I retired 5 years ago from performance, and I didn't teach for a while. And then Shakira of Ohio said, I want to come out and take some classes. And so she did, and then people around here found out about it, and they said, well, if she gets to take classes. And since I love teaching, I was taking tap dancing at the time, which I was terrible at, but I liked it. Well, you know, I only took it for 6 months, so I probably could have gotten at least a little better. But so now I teach the once a month, and now people are saying, well, why don't you teach weekly classes again? So I might do that. But I teach workshops all over the United States and in Canada, and I teach private classes, and actually I do quite a bit of teaching if I think about it. And I love it. I love teaching. There's nothing I like more.
You can certainly tell that you love teaching.
Thank you.
So amazing. I can't. I've taken one workshop from you and loved it.
Where was it?
It was in the southern state, Tennessee.
Oh, yeah. I was there, a couple of years ago or something. How neat. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I always enjoyed. I haven't been around a teacher like this before.
Well, thank you.
You're the real thing. You're the real deal.
Thank you so much, Marsha. I really appreciate that. It's good to hear.
The rest of us just try.
Well, and that counts for a lot, If you really care about the student and you give them the best information you've got, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Marsha, I'm seeing all sorts of comments here. Just in case you wanted to touch on anything else, you mentioned, about 20 minutes ago, Deborah, you are right. I think there should be a teacher seminar.
I do teaching seminars, in fact. I haven't done one for a long time, but yeah. I did one in Virginia some years ago, and Shakira of Ohio was in on that one too. And I've done a couple of other ones. I think I did one in Illinois with Sidonia Sipe. I'm trying to think where else. I teach it's called Student Awareness, but I'm thinking of changing the title to Student Oriented Teaching, because that more says what I actually do, because that's why we're there. We're there to teach students.
And you don't become a teacher because you think you have the ability to dance well. That has nothing to do with it. Because you have
that's
to,
right.
It has to come What you say and what you do has to reflect on that student. And that's all it is. It has nothing to do with you, the person, the teacher.
It I agree.
It has to do with what you're giving.
I agree. And so many
not
teachers.
Like, can you do this? Can you do that? You know, it's you know, what you have carved out from your research over the years is what it is. Well, that's what I'm impressed.
You know, teaching and performing are two different skills entirely. And right. Some of the best performers you've ever seen may not necessarily be great teachers. And some of the more average entertainers that you see may not be, they may be incredible teachers. So yeah. I for 7 years, I worked as a costume designer and shop supervisor at Eastern Washington University in Cheney, Washington. And we had an artist in residence there. His name is Leonard Fowler, or was. And Leonard was the most amazing teacher. He actually developed ways of teaching Russian ballet for Americans. And also he developed New York jazz. He was one of the people who invented, quote unquote, New York jazz. And he was such a pleasure to work with. He was just an amazing man. And to watch him teach, I mean, like I learned so much just when I would go in to, watch the class to see what we were going to be costuming and things like that, just the way that he was. You know, his presence as a man who was totally invested in his people was just, it gives me chills now. I can't explain to you how wonderful this man was. And I learned a lot just being there in his presence. You know, it was wonderful. I have a lot of people to thank.
Lucky you.
Yes, that's how I feel.
Did that cover
it, Marcia? Pardon
me? Did that pretty much cover it?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. All right. Okay, and Dawn had some comments too. So let me just scroll through here. Here's one in particular. She says, there are a lot of, quote, unknowable questions too. There simply are no answers. Acknowledging the unknowable is powerful, especially when it comes to history. Yeah.
I agree. And not only history, there's this sort of primal thing that happens in dance that you can witness, but you don't have the verbal thing to say about it. You know, it's just there. It's something that there's probably not a human being in the world that doesn't understand it in their gut. But to intellectualize that is impossible.
I completely agree.
And you cannot take a picture of it with your cell phone either.
No, you can't.
Put
it's
the
true.
Phone down.
Very rarely.
Oh, Dawn, yeah, the power of Shireen's gaze and her active eye contact. Truly, she sees everybody in her
She
class.
Does. She absolutely does.
Yeah.
She sort of saved me in some ways because I was the only Egyptian belly dancer in my town. And as such, I was, you know, a lot of times called a purist and hard to get along with. And it's true, maybe I don't work and play well with others, but I have a sweet spirit, so I don't know what the problem was. So anyway, then I went to her class, and she right away said, you've got it, you get it, you know, and she, on the strength of those words, gave me something so special. And then she'd come and she would tweak some tiny little thing, and I would feel the rightness of it, you know, just something I had been trying to do for years and couldn't quite get. I would just feel that rightness. So she is a very special, special lady. That's
yes,
all there is
I
to
agree.
It.
I agree. She was teaching a drum solo in a workshop that one of Didi Assad's events in Dallas. And that's where I had a chance to take with her. And I remember her telling me afterwards, the workshop was over with. She says, you really pay attention and you watch and you absorb everything. But she noticed that.
Yes.
You know? And she talked to other students around
that's
the class
right.
too. It wasn't just me. But I think there is nothing so valuable than a teacher who acknowledges her student. or his students.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're teaching a workshop or a private class or a regular weekly class or what. Every single person in that class needs to know that you know they're there.
Right.
Every single one.
And they love to hear their name.
Yeah, I can, a lot of times I can't even remember my own name.
Yeah. I used to be a lot better at it myself, but
yeah, I can still go up to a person and say, that was divine, you know? And if they didn't get another thing right in that class, if they do one thing, you know, sometimes that's so important to them, to let them know, you know, that they did something right. I mean, I'm the world's slowest lower. Learner. I went to a workshop with one of my students a long time ago, and I told her on the way there, well, I'm the slowest learner in the world. And it was a workshop with Nadia Hamdi, who has the patience of an angel. She's got little wings that you can actually see, because she doesn't come up and slap you because you're so dumb. You know, I mean, she's just amazing. So anyway, it took, I think Nadia stood with me for 10 minutes helping me to figure out this thing. It was so simple once I got it, but like, it was like, you know, it was just like half of my brains had escaped my head or something. And so on the way home, my student keeps looking at me with just this look on her face like, what's wrong with you? And finally I said, why do you keep looking at me like that? She goes, I never would have believed you were that dumb. It's just like, I told you I'm slow, right? You know, but when I learn something, it's what it's supposed to be. I don't ever claim to know it if I don't, you know. Yeah. If I say this is how it's done, then that's how it's done, because I have learned very slowly, but very, very completely. Right. And it took me 15 years to learn how to do an upward undulation from the pubic bone. I mean, it was just, and then Firuz Aram came along one day and I went, okay. And I did. You know, so I know the agony. I can feel the agony still.
But you also have the thrill of the victory too.
That's right. Every single day.
Okay. Well, we are butting up against the, we're earth butting up against the 90 minute mark.
Okay. Well, we better get off of here, huh?
And you know, I didn't ask, Sophia, let me just unmute you, Sophie. And do you have any questions?
Hi, darling.
Hello. I'm not a teacher. I'm just listening and I'm enjoying everything.
Okay, great. Well, I just wanted to check with you because I didn't want to leave you out since I couldn't see you.
Okay.
Don't forget who loves you, baby.
Thank you.
Do not forget who loves you, baby.
I'm not forgetting at all.
Okay, good. I won't ever.
Okay.
We're old friends, very old friends.
I gathered that, yes. Okay, well, unless there are any other questions. Yeah. Oh, I didn't ask Sue. She's at work.
Thank you all so much. I've had a wonderful time, and I hope you guys have too. And I hope to meet everybody in person again someday. I've never met you, Don, but I hope we get to meet up sometime. Or you, Elizabeth. And the rest of you I know. So just mwah, mwah. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Okay. And I appreciate everybody coming. This is my first time hosting the clubhouse.
Hello.
And
can you hear
Deborah,
me?
You Elizabeth made my is job talking. Easy.
Oh, you made mine easy, Elizabeth.
I had to unmute myself. Yes, I live in New York City. Thank you for paying attention to me and calling me out. See, you practice what you preach. I started very late. I'll be brief. I started very late in belly dancing and been dancing basically, sort of. And now I teach seniors at a senior center.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's very rewarding.
I bet. I know. I know exactly what you mean. I'm so happy for you that you're doing that.
Well, and I should say that one of my former students who has grown up to be an incredible dancer, her name's Shining, and she's going to be in New York in August or September. If you know Morocco, you can ask her more about it.
Know who?
Her name is Shining.
If you know Morocco, you can ask.
Yeah, and if you know Morocco. Yeah, Morocco, I think she's going to be staying at Morocco's house. And she might be doing some classes while she's there. And she would be a good person to study with.
Okay, great, because it's very important. I always had obstacles learning. I think what I'm saying is sharing is going to benefit everybody else in some fashion. But I was such a slow learner, and the moves weren't broken down clearly enough.
I understand. I'm a slow learner too.
Yeah, and I just couldn't, you know, follow all these tall girls in front of me and like, bumper to bumper students and stuff.
Yeah, it's awful.
But you hit a lot of things. Yeah, but I know what it's like. It was very painful because I just couldn't learn.
Well, you just have a different learning style.
That's right. Yeah, there's lots of ways to learn, and teachers need to tap into that, but. Yeah. Heather's trying to move on, and I want to thank everybody again. I've had a wonderful time, and thank you so much for joining in, all of you. I really appreciate it. And Heather, just clap, clap, clap. You did a wonderful job.
Thank you, and if I so appreciate you all coming. And if I could just do a little housekeeping here at the end. this is the end of the call, but it's not the end of the conversation. We do have a private Facebook group. It's the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse on Facebook. And I'm going to send out an email. Elizabeth, watch for it. It'll come from BellyDanceGeek/Heather Wayman. Okay. And there's going to be an invitation in there to get the recording of this call. It's just going to be the audio, not the video. Okay. And it'll also have an invitation to join the Facebook group, and you'll have to be approved. So there'll be a little delay because I want to make sure that everybody that goes into the group is supposed to be in there. And there'll also be a link back to Aisha's page, the episode page with the resources, the Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence information, a survey link, also for feedback. If you've got ideas on topics, speakers, any improvements that I can make, I would appreciate hearing about those. And I also want to let you know that the next Clubhouse call is going to be Thursday, July 11th at 2 p.m. Pacific. And my guest is going to be Vanessa Friedman of Cairo. She's going to talk about her experience in Cairo, and she'll have lots of great stuff to talk about too. So I'm really excited about that.
Nice.
So if you know somebody that would be interested, invite them to join at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. Thank you, Aisha. I appreciate it very much. And
thank you. I had a wonderful time.
Perfect. Until next time, happy dancing.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. For more geektacular resources, visit us at bellydancegeek.com.